Welcome to our Friday Five Live podcast hosted by Meg Foster. Meg has spent 20 years in higher education focused on student success initiatives and working in areas such as orientation, faculty development, online learning, student leadership, and first-year initiatives.
Happy Friday. Hopefully the background noise here won't be too bad today, so apologies if it is, but very fortunate to get to have a conversation with Melissa Carlton. Last in the spring and March, we were like, there is so much going on in our world of higher education legally. And Melissa was kind enough to come on and talk with us then. And we said, well, that was so much fun. Could we do this quarterly? And Melissa is gracious enough to say, that sounds like a good idea. So we welcome you back to our podcast and just really appreciate your time and your wise counsel, because this is very complicated legal waters that we are swimming in right now, hopefully treading water in. So thanks, Melissa, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I love being on your show.
And just as a reminder, for those of you who maybe haven't joined us before, we do love the chat. So feel free, put your question in the chat. While I have prepared some questions always for Melissa, and she has helped me refine those questions, we welcome your questions, your comments, what you're trying to figure out today as well. So just as a reminder, Melissa joins us from Bricker Graydon, where she is the partner in the higher education chair, which, bless your heart, you are a woman in demand right now. So,
and that is why I'm on vacation today, Meg.
Right. And we appreciate you joining us from your vacation. So just to kind of start off, I thought we could kind of begin with this big picture. Catch us up. What's been the most kind of significant legal development? And I feel like there's been so much, particularly in the last 2 weeks, that we could probably spend hours having this conversation today.
Well, and frankly, even this morning, right, the White House issued an executive order on college sports and how they're going to save college sports. So I haven't dug into that one, but it's definitely something that you want to forward on to your athletic department friends. There has been so much happening since March, and it's almost hard to boil it down into things that are understandable, because the things that were true when things were happening in March have now morphed and changed. So let me go through just a couple of things I don't think we talked about last time. Number one, just recently, the Supreme Court issued a decision about nationwide injunctions versus class actions. And this sounds like something that maybe is a little bit too geeky for this crowd, but I'll tell you what, it's going to change the way we watch these lawsuits go forward, because we have had so many situations. You remember last year when we were all dealing with, is it the 2020 regs for Title IX? Is it the 2024 regs for Title IX? And then we went through and we had 26 states come out in one direction and 24 come out in the other direction. And then we had the nationwide injunction, essentially, that made the rule in January. We'd all been waiting and holding our breath for that nationwide injunction. And it looks like that's not going to be something that affects us in the same way anymore. The Supreme Court really disfavored nationwide injunctions, basically because it wasn't something that people did on July 4th, 1776 in the common law courts of England, or the equity courts of England. And so therefore it must not be something that we do now, but they did give us an out. They said that class action lawsuits are probably the way to go to achieve a similar result. So how does that change things? It means that a lot of the lawsuits that we had been watching are maybe going to stall. If they ended up in a nationwide injunction, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of them try to switch over to class action. So we're going to see a little bit of a pause in making sure that we're meeting all the procedural requirements to the extent that those challenges are going forward. It also means that you're going to have to watch and see what classes your institution may fit into, because it's not enough to see if some court down in Texas or court up in Massachusetts is going to make a nationwide ruling. We're going to have to watch and see, okay, what is affected here in terms of each class action, and are we going to be potentially benefiting from that? So that's kind of, like I said, legal geeky, but important. And if you're a lawyer, it's definitely something that we've been watching. And I have noted since we had oral arguments in that case a while ago, that we have seen more cases being filed as class actions, because I think people saw the tea leaves on that. Other things, since we last talked in March, I don't know how else to describe it, but there has been a federal targeting of institutions on multiple layers. It used to be that you know, if you're an institution, you might get a letter in the mail or, you know, through email from the U.S. Department of Education that says, gee, you know, Title VI or Title IX is a law that we are obligated to enforce. We have received a complaint or we've received information suggesting that you may not be in compliance with that law. We're going to open up an investigation. We're going to need the following information from you as we, you know, launch our investigation. And just a reminder that we are neutral in our analysis. And that was kind of the pattern that you could assume if you were under investigation from a federal agency. What we have seen since March is kind of the amping up of the rhetoric in some, but not all of these letters. Sometimes the amping up is, you know, suggestions that they are tired of what we are doing. I think one of them recently from the DOJ said that the Department of Justice patience is wearing thin with the institution. You know, so we're starting to see more little comments like that thrown in. At the same time, some of these investigations that got opened up in March are now closing out, and it's unclear how much investigation really happened beyond the review of newspaper articles and a discussion with the complainants. And so these things are happening kind of on multiple levels. We're seeing them, maybe the U.S. Department of Education is addressing a Title IX issue, but maybe also the Department of Energy and the Department of Agriculture and people that issue grants and have grant assurances that say that you must comply with Title IX, right? Like those sorts of things suddenly, whereas maybe it was just one agency that would be looking at you for a Title IX or a Title VI violation more often. Now we're seeing multiple agencies, multiple grant providers opening up the same or similar kinds of investigations. They might be cooperating. We've seen some cooperation between the U.S. Department of Education and Health and Human Services on those fronts. I think it's more like we're gonna address this potential issue of non-compliance, but we're gonna go at it from many different directions, which can be confusing. And then we're gonna take it into like 3D. Now if we're going after you for this particular situation, then maybe we also want to look into this other thing and this other thing and this other thing. And we've seen this kind of explode in terms of Harvard being, you know, the quintessential example right now, where it's not just your Title VI. You know, concerns and anti-Semitism issues. It may also be, you know, should you be allowed to have foreign students on your campus? And what are we doing with foreign funding? And all of these other pieces from different parts of different agencies that are now seemingly all going to the same institution at the same time. So it feels more targeted than it previously did under prior administrations. And we've seen institutions react to that, right? So we've seen Harvard file multiple lawsuits or amend their complaint. We've seen Columbia, who just signed a rather large resolution agreement. And then for some of the institutions, it's been interesting. Before this year, I can't remember ever seeing the U.S. Department of Education publish a proposed resolution agreement or publicize what might be in that. And I've seen more and more of that. They'll say, we've found this institution in violation. We're working with them on a resolution agreement, and here are our demands. And then they list those out. And that's really something that hasn't been publicized in previous administrations. And it adds a new dimension to how those negotiations happen, right? Because now it's not something where we have two parties sitting down and trying to figure out what will work for everyone. There's a new public pressure that can go in multiple different directions, right? But it adds a different dimension to those discussions. So I think those are the two biggest things that I see. But obviously, there's just so much going on right now. I could talk for days about this.
Well, and I do want to, I mean, the Columbia, that was the decision, I mean, has just... so much commentary on it, so much concern. Sort of, what are things that institutions should be thinking about as we sort of look through that settlement, right? Where they've said, we're going to pay. Where do you see legally, like that kind of going?
So a couple different things, and this just came out while I was here trolling around, at Disney World Park. So I haven't dug into all of the information about it, but I will tell you, anytime you are negotiating between parties who have required ongoing relationship. It is a different dynamic than when you are negotiating with two parties whose relationship has ended. So for example, if you're an institution and you enter into a severance agreement with an employee, that employee is done. They're not still working there. You're not, you know, thinking about an ongoing relationship. And so you negotiate things differently in that circumstance. But contrast that with like a family law situation where you have a divorce and the divorce involves children and the children are young. Even if you reach a settlement at this point in time of how things are going to go forward, you have agreement on custody arrangements and child support, those things are going to change over the life of the student potentially or the child. And it's because of that nature of the ongoing relationship. So in this circumstance, what we want is a settlement that says, and we're done here, right? This is a thing that we can all move forward and have peace. And instead, what we're getting is this is an ongoing relationship between the parties. And whatever happens the next day is potentially subject to a new violation and a new dispute and a new discussion and a new reason that they may need to change the resolution or enter into a new resolution or enter into a lawsuit. In other words, it's a lot harder to guarantee yourself peace in a situation when you are negotiating with the federal government and they have ongoing oversight over you. And so then the question becomes, then what do we do? Do we buy our peace for now, not knowing what it may lead to? Or do we fight for our peace, which may or may not actually give lasting peace, depending on how the case comes out, right? So I think it's institutions are stuck between a rock and a hard place because they need to have the funding to maintain all the wonderful things that they've done for our community in terms of, you know, research and development and also taking care of our students and building our leaders for tomorrow. And they have to find a way of staying open, frankly, right? So we have a lot of institutions right now that are really struggling from a budgetary perspective. And while a lot of the institutions that have been targeted in the news media have larger endowments, maybe that's not completely a coincidence here, right? But they have larger endowments or larger budgets, and they're under a little bit less financial stress. But as this expands and they start looking at different institutions, I think you're going to have more institutions that are really struggling with that. I need to stay alive. What do I do in the moment to stay alive versus how can I guarantee lasting peace?
That's such an, I think, such an important explanation as far as there, that we're sort of in this place where we're not able to come to resolution. And so, you know, it's a good reminder because it does feel, quite frankly, we've talked about this a lot in the podcast for the last, like, it's just exhausting, right? Like, because there's constantly the need to respond, to react, concern. Are my funds frozen? Do I, you know, yeah. How can I? So I want to go to question number two here. And I hadn't thought about this as I put this question together, but you're in Ohio, like for your work, which is kind of a hot seat right now, as far as a lot of DEI legislation and things like that. And I saw North Carolina, I think this week is also passing kind of similar legislation. So any advice, thoughts, things we should consider, institutions that are maybe navigating this in a way that you're like, oh, that's a clever response that we should think about as far as, you know, our institutions are really working, I think, so hard to try to continue as best they can to preserve a commitment to DEI, to, you know, supporting the communities that they exist within, to representing those communities. And as Melissa knows, you know, I'm a UVA alum, and we've just had this kind of very publicly play out at my alma mater. So I'll stop at that and turn it over to you.
Yeah. So first off, if you're a public institution and your legislation is what made you a public institution in the first place, and they govern you, as is the case in most states in terms of their public university system, you're stuck, right? You got to comply with your state law. State laws have not always gone into private institutions on this anti-DEI pushback, and so there's multiple layers here again, right? What does the legislation mean, right? Some of these things are saying we don't permit illegal DEI. Okay, great, but what we're doing is legal. So where does that put us? And the illegality is in the eye of the beholder, so to speak, right? And your legislators have the power of the purse in some, you know, in a lot of circumstances. So, you know, what is it exactly that you're required to do may or may not be clear in your state. And in that sort of circumstance, your best bet is to, you know, have your lobbyists start figuring that out for you, right? Because it's probably better to get clarity through, you know, executive agencies that are enforcing the law than it is to try to figure it out in the context of a lawsuit, if you can, again, because you have many long-running relationships in there. So you may be more limited at a private or a public institution as to what realistically you can do, depending on what that state legislation looks like. At privacy or at private schools, what we are dealing with is, number one, is there state legislation that is affecting us in the same way? And if you're just looking at the federal law, we have an executive order that says you can't engage in illegal DEI. Well, yeah, don't do that. Don't engage in illegal DEI, right? And how would I define illegal DEI? That would be things that are done that violate Title VI, right? Or Title VII or Title IX. Those things would be illegal because the laws prohibited that information or prohibit those actions. So DEI isn't necessarily a concept that is sufficiently defined to say this is illegal as a DEI piece, as opposed to what does the law actually says? What does it prohibit? We know it prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin, sex, disability, and all of those pieces, religion. And then how do we make sure that the things that we have been doing under a DEI umbrella aren't violating those laws? And here's the thing. If it violates those laws now, it was already violating those laws before January 20th, right? So we have to stop doing things that are illegal. That's just a good pro tip. You can take that to the bank, right? Don't do illegal things. If you go back to how do I balance this DEI and what people think is DEI and what am I doing and where does it all fall? Go back to the, am I discriminating on the basis of one of the protected traits? And if so, why? And if so, is that something that is permitted by law? For example, in Title IX, we know we can have fraternities and sororities. We know we can use sex as a bona fide occupational qualification, right, for certain things. So there are certain exceptions that are built in that allow us to discriminate. And if we're discriminating for other reasons, then what is the purpose? How are we going to defend that? I think what people will find when they start digging down, and this is something that I've kind of been thinking about a lot over the last few months, is I think I know what DEI means to me and for the organizations that I work with, but I'm not sure that the organizations that I work with would all, if they put it to a test of all of their students and all their employees, would they define it in the same way? And I think they wouldn't. I think everybody's kind of got their little spin, which is, of course, is part of the vagueness of the illegal DEI mandate in the first place, right? So what I started doing is digging down to, okay, what are the values that we really want to promote? We want to make sure that we're reducing barriers for people to get in. We want to make sure that when they get here, they feel comfortable being their authentic selves. And that is formulated differently. So in other words, maybe start thinking about not using the term DEI as a shorthand for cluster of values that your institution holds that may look a little differently from institution to institution. Define those values and pin what you do on those values that are maybe a little bit more specific or easier to grasp to folks. But I feel like, especially over the last 5 to 10 years, we've had more kind of shorthanding for DEI. And frankly, I think that's part of the reason that we're getting in trouble because of it, because we may be doing things that we're labeling as DEI and in fact do violate federal law. And that is something that the federal government has long had the power to encourage or require us to roll back. And I think it's the kind of the borderlands, the in-between spaces that are complicated right now.
That's such a good point that we need to understand the language that we're using. Right? What does this mean? What does this mean for our institution? And you know, an important reminder that I think while, you know, institutions, educational institutions, I mean, you know, I think we value these kinds of our communities. We value equity and access and those critical things that we provide to our community. Maybe sometimes we have been doing things.
Sure.
Right. Like, this is not, none of this is like all bad, all good. Like, there's so much gray, I think, in the work that we're doing here. Nate brought up a really interesting question. He was like, there seems to be a lack of total mention in the news with regards to community colleges, right? It's all very four-year focus, which is interesting because we all know, you know, the mission of community colleges. Now, I do know that in the state where I teach, we have been, for example, there have been learning objectives removed from the course I teach around appreciating multiculturalism and those sorts of things. Topics. Titles have been changed for people's job roles. But yeah, just curious if you are seeing anything with regards to community colleges in this space legally, since so much has been focused on Harvard.
Yeah, so I'm not really sure the reason. I mean, so everything that we've talked about so far applies to community colleges in the same way as it applies to 4 years, right? A couple things that differentiate community colleges. Number one, they don't have endowments. I don't know how much that plays into it. They also don't tend to do a lot of research, so they don't have as many research grants that are on the table, so it leaves fewer avenues to address a particular issue that the federal government wishes to enforce. So it may just be kind of a lower level concerns with those sorts of institutions, just because there's fewer things to be able to, fewer avenues to pursue. But no, for sure, the DEI pieces, you know, Title VI issues, Title IX issues are all very relevant. I would also say, you know, I think community colleges tend to have a different population that may not get as involved in some of the protest activity. You know, we know that from a Title IX perspective, most of them don't have dorms. So it's a different situation in terms of, you know, a lot of the different types of sexual harassment types that we see on those campuses. So I suspect it's just a combination of all of that combined.
I do want to, I'm going to skip question three for a second, go to question four. I'm just seeing such interesting things in the news about speech.
Yeah.
And, you know, like just the other week, Carnegie Mellon, I mean, just as a tiny example, right? They have this very hallowed tradition of a fence that they paint. It was painted with messages that the president did not appreciate. The president of the college, I will say, did not appreciate because of the nature of visitors on campus. And so had it painted over, and students have really protest, which I'm kind of impressed by because it is the summer. So we know you don't have your whole student population on campus. I mean, so the fact that, I mean, these students are being very vocal about their freedom of speech. But I also know this is a topic happening. If I'm understanding correctly, and I am so very much not a legal expert, one of the big cases that is circulating right now in the courts has, or that is, that just been heard, it's not circulating, it's just been heard in the last week, has to do with speech and their implications. I think that's got to do with protest on campus and the implications then in higher education. So I feel like this has always been a sticky wicket on college campuses for as long as there have been students to have a voice. There has been the concern about how are we honoring then that freedom of speech on our campuses. So I'll stop there and turn it over to you.
Yeah. So where to even start with free speech? So yes, you're going to have student groups that are challenging the way institutions are addressing free speech issues right now. But the reason that institutions are addressing free speech issues the way that they are right now is in large part due to the way the federal government is investigating and enforcing Title VI in terms of protests, right? So one of the things that we're seeing is the federal government isn't allowed to impose, you know, certain speech restrictions on campus, right? So they can't say, hey, campus, you have to do all of these things that in itself would violate title or the First Amendment. That being said, I'm not sure that's not what we're seeing right now, right? So we've got some issues, and to the extent that institutions want to challenge that perspective, you know, they can go and file a lawsuit, or they can file a settlement, or, you know, reach a settlement agreement in an attempt to sort that out. But what we're seeing is the federal government really pushing institutions into certain ways of handling speech. And one of the biggest controversies right now in this realm is what definitions apply to enforcing Title VI in an anti-Semitism context, right? So we have a definition that the International Holocaust Remembrance Association has put out regarding anti-Semitism, and it gives some examples of things that qualify as anti-Semitic behavior. And And the federal government has been really pushing institutions that are being investigated to adopt that definition and then to discipline individuals who speak out in ways that would violate that definition and declare the speech anti-Semitic. It's complicated, though, because the law doesn't prohibit anti-Semitism. The law prohibits race discrimination and, you know, shared ethnicity and all of those things that protects, you know, people who are of the Jewish background. And so how do we get from the Title VI to the IHRA definition being enforced? And how is that changing the way that speech on campus works? Because some of the speech, when I read the IHRA definition, I would say that may be more political in nature than it is necessarily discriminatory in nature. It's complicated, right? Because we have overlapping political entities who may identify with certain ethnicities or religions or, you know, those sorts of things, but they're also not completely that. They are separate from that. And I cannot untangle thousands of years worth of history on that front to determine, you know, what is appropriate. And I don't pretend to have any silver bullets in that, but I just keep going back to what I have to help my clients comply with is Title VI. And the farther we get from that language, the more we're relying on guidance. And interestingly enough, you know, last year it was that the Supreme Court struck down that kind of judicial deference to an agency's interpretation. So as we watch these new resolution agreements go through, I think you're going to see the students start to challenge the institutions more about the way that speech is being implemented. I think that's going to find its way through the courts, and we're going to start seeing some court decisions about how we're applying those definitions to speech. And I did a quick search earlier this week. I was looking into it for something else, and I wasn't finding a lot of court support for imposing that definition on institutions. But I think it's coming a little bit differently now from the federal government. So that's what I would really watch, is those definitions and how they're being used in a Title VI context, because that is where so many of the protests are happening these days.
It's just very, very complicated. And as mm-hmm. you said, it's so layered and so nuanced and it just incredibly complex. Well, and I'm wondering, to reach back up to that, my previous question, anything new that's happening with regards to Title IX? I mean, As we mentioned, you know, a little bit before, I was interested to read, I think it was late last week or early this week, about Department of Energy, you know, trying to very quietly, I think, initiate some, not maybe going to use the right word here, but rules with regards to how they're, you know, they're funding research and, oh, well, you have to be meeting these standards, one of which I think violated Title IX language and definition. And so people, you know, said, no, like that's a violation of Title IX. Anyway, so I'll stop there again. And just what's the latest?
So that's definitely one of the things that are happening. So all of the federal agencies that give money have been subject to Title IX and have had regulations. The Department of Energy is different because they issued directed rules without going through notice and comment, but the rules don't match what the Department of Education had put out. And the rules were about athletics. And if you are thinking, why does the Department of Energy care about athletics? Well, they were supposed to care all along, I think is the best answer. But usually they haven't. And I have seen this under previous administrations. I remember many years ago, I dealt with the Department of Agriculture addressing things from a Title IX perspective with a school district that I was working with. I didn't remember what the issue was, but I remember being puzzled and then going through the regulations and realizing the National School Lunch Program also had a Title IX assurance, and that was why they were going after it. So if you're wondering who can enforce things on your campus in terms of, you know, Title IX, Title VI, and that sort of thing, go read your grant assurances, because that tells, it spells out in very clear detail, you know, I am promising to comply with this, that, and the other thing. And those are agencies that have authority to enforce on your campus. You probably have a lot of grant assurances. And if I can get nothing else to schools right now, it's please read your grant assurances before you sign them. Because right now those are changing, and they're changing in ways that may not be something that you feel comfortable signing. So please make sure that anybody who's signing them on your campus is being thoughtful and not just signing them as a matter of paperwork, which was the standard practice for many years on many campuses. But anyway, I digress. All right. So aside from Title IX being addressed by agencies that typically haven't been taking the lead in that area. Title IX has mostly focused on transgender women athletes. So there seems to be kind of a standard resolution agreement package where you're going to stop doing that. You're going to modify your policies and procedures to stop doing that. You're going to go back through your records. And if someone should have won something and they didn't because there was a transgender athlete that won it, they're going to have you re-award that person the award that they would have gotten if the transgender woman athlete hadn't been there, and then also send them a personalized notice of apology to the person who did not win originally because a transgender woman athlete won. So that seems to be what they're looking for right now. It's an interesting enforcement priority. I have cases that are literally 15 years old that have been sitting with OCI for, you know, over a decade that haven't been addressed. But the transgender piece seems to be what they really want to focus on right now. And so that's what they're doing. There is a transgender athlete case that was just accepted for review by the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's the Little versus Hecox case out of Idaho. And so hopefully by this time next year, by the end of June, really, we'll have a decision on that case as to maybe getting some national standards in there. But right now, a lot of institutions find it complicated because they may have requirements to not discriminate on the basis of gender identity, but then federal law is telling them this, state law is telling them that sort of thing. Federal law typically trumps state law, but it gets complicated when you're digging through the details. And so if you're working through that situation, I would suggest talking with your campus's lawyer to make sure that you are handling it in the best way possible, given whatever's on your plate.
No, and I feel like always we would recommend and encourage people to make sure they're kind of up to date with regards to training and, you know, got a question, know the Title IX coordinator on your campus and be working with them. Yes, but...
One more thing on the Title IX front, this just came to light not too long ago, that the in the definition of Title IX sexual harassment under the 2020 regulations, they defer to the definition used by the FBI in their uniform crime reporting system for certain types of sexual assault. And one of those types was just modified. So the definition of fondling for purposes of UCR reporting has been modified and expanded. And so you're going to want to connect with your Title IX counsel to see about getting that definition changed in your Title IX policy going forward.
Important. Again, we're so grateful for minds like yours, Melissa, that keep track of all of these changes and make sure we're educated about them, because it's so much feels like whiplash. We're 2024. No, we're back to 2020 in 2025. So
yeah, it has been a little bit of a complex year in terms of regulatory compliance.
Well, any advice? I mean, this has been, I think we're going to continue to see an interesting year unfold. November will bring us another set of elections. And I know we've done, had several very helpful conversations through Innovative Educators with regards to guiding our campuses through election processes and seasons, right? Because that's when we tend to see things pop up with regards to free speech and campus protest and safety violation, just all kinds of, it kind of opens up a little bit of a, sometimes a can of worms. And I know that's challenging because we've just come through an election, right? And where there was no time to kind of take a deep breath and collect oneself because we're rolling right back in it again. So just any advice, anything you're seeing that campuses are doing well, maybe, or that you would want us to consider and think about as we get prepared for this fall semester and what it might bring? And Melissa, I don't know if you froze or I froze, but one of us froze. So
it was me. I just got the note that my internet connection was unstable. Sorry about that. Hotel Wi-Fi, not what it used to be.
So let me know if you want me to repeat.
Yeah, just give me the question and then I'll go ahead and answer.
So the question was kind of talking about the challenges that institutions face as we prepare for the fall. Specifically, I'm thinking about, yet we have another election cycle coming up.
Yes.
In the fall.
Yep.
Any guidance, best practices, things we should consider as we think about kind of the implications there? I know this is a time when a lot of, you know, we've got potential student protests, people using our campuses who may be from outside of our organizations.
Yeah, I mean, so if you are, regardless of whether you're public or private, make sure that you have your protest policy in order, so that you know what is expected and also what you're holding people to in terms of a disciplinary standard. Make sure that it is, you're going to want to work with your lawyer to make sure that it's compliant with not only federal obligations, but any state obligations that may apply. And then you need to make sure that the folks on your campus know about the policy, not just the student organizations that may be, you know, protesting, but also, you know, how confident are you that campus safety is going to know how to address certain situations? So to me, this is a time for tabletop hypotheticals, running through, you know, get a group of people around the table that is like your command center if you were to have a large scale protest, and how are we handling different concerns that come up, and does everyone at the table know who to communicate with, where to get better resources, you know, who at the table can help them navigate certain things. I think that's the best you can do right now. I don't know what kind of protests we're even going to be facing in the coming months, right? We know we've been dealing with the fallout from the Israeli-Gaza situation, but that's not the only thing people are upset about these days. And we've seen protests on lots of different topics. So, you know, I think it's just the process, making sure we understand the process and that the process or that the procedural expectations are out there for your campus community to be aware of.
I really love the idea of tabletop exercises in particular. And one of our great, Naomi Sig, who's actually at John Carroll University, so not too far from you, often, you know, helps institutions kind of work through those very sort of things as we get ready. Great suggestion. All right. So what are the court cases? What are you keeping your eye on legally here as we transition? I mean, we're all moving people back. Camp class starts a month or so. What should we be paying attention to?
Honestly, you know, the things that I read every morning, first off, the higher ed media has done a fabulous job of not just covering the things as they happen, but also covering the things like in a more dimensional aspect as we move forward. So I read the higher ed media every morning. And then I watch what's going on in terms of executive orders to determine if there's anything that might affect clients. I watch the U.S. Department of Education's news feed, and then also OCR's news feed. That's been a little quiet lately, but I still try to check it pretty regularly. In terms of lawsuits being filed, there are a number of litigation trackers that are available online that have been really helpful to see as things develop, but things are very slow to develop. You know, lawsuits are not the best way to resolve situations, just because they tend to be really ponderous, right? So we've got 8 million procedural things to do. And if you're watching some of the court dockets, you know, there may be 15 notices of appearances filed before anybody gets anything done, right? So you just get notices for no reason. So I think the media has been really helpful in kind of helping us understand what's going on here. I don't think there's any silver bullet though for what to watch. At this point, the information and the concerns are being raised from so many different directions that I think you have to find a couple of news sources that you trust and just keep monitoring those to the best you can. And make sure that other folks on your campus are also monitoring. It can be really hard to doom scroll as you know, and just read the news, but it is an important part of our jobs right now. At least that's what I tell my husband before I reach for the whiskey every night. So, you know, it's rough, and I'm not going to lie. It's a lot of pressure and a lot of emotion that comes up with reading some of the things that are happening right now. But I do think that's the only way you can really work to be informed. And I, you know, it's funny. One of the questions on here is like, how can you future-proof your policies? Bless your heart. I have no idea. Cause it could all change tomorrow. So
right,
I hate
right.
to be a downer. I'm at the happiest place on earth. I should not be a downer.
You are. You're. I mean, this seems like a good balance. Our conversation with Disney. Sarah's asked about listing some sources. Melissa follows. We can send those out. I know I find Inside Higher Ed, Chronicle of
Right.
Higher Ed to be really helpful resources. I would also say we Innovative Educators has a Monday newsletter that you can sign up for. It's kind of the five things that are happening that week in higher ed, a lot of which kind of summarizes some of the legal. At this point, they're normally articles 1, 2, and 3 have something to do with legal implications in higher education. You know, it's interesting that you brought up the executive order that was released today. I mean, and who's had a chance to look at that, right? With regards to college athletics and protecting college athletics, we're going to have to do a whole podcast on that because the NIL implications and the new, and yes, the legal decision.
I'm not your person for that one. I looked at it and I was like, oh my goodness, we've got an athletics team that deals with all of that stuff. And it's just, I don't know how the federal government is going to save college athletics, but that's the title of the executive order. I think there are many things that need to go into saving college athletics, and I'll just leave that to the experts.
Right. And that's not us. Also yesterday, Department of Ed released a Dear Colleague letter, and I'm going to read the title of this here, on guidance on the use of federal grant funds to improve education outcomes using artificial intelligence. So there were several things released yesterday, and they're asking for public comment on a proposed rule regarding, I'll summarize, advancing artificial intelligence in education. And a new Winning the Race, America's AI Action Plan was released as well. So a whole new area, right, that we can mine, I think, for probably important information about how AI may or may not be used. So we'll need to, and I'm sure that's its own very complex set of legal issues and advice.
I would just recall, was it Linda McMahon was talking about how A1 was going to, you know, revolutionize education, right? So maybe we start with AI, not A1,
right?
Before we start to explain. But I, you know, bless their hearts. It's a lot to wrap around. I think we're just starting to see the tinge of how this is going to affect us, right? But I also know that I have access to very good AI materials within my law firm, and there are still a lot of problems with relying on that to do things without checking meticulously to make sure that things are accurate. And so while it's fun to play around with and start to imagine the possibilities, if they want to try to regulate that, I guess go ahead.
Right. Well, maybe that should be our next t-shirt, you know, A1 versus AI, or we're A1 for everyone. Melissa, I appreciate you joining us from the wonderful world of Disney today, which I do think is a nice counterbalance, the happiest place on earth and a discussion about legal issues in higher education. And it seems like maybe that helps the fulcrum, the pendulum to stop in the middle, right? It's not all good or all bad. It is, but it is all complicated. So thank you. We always appreciate your time and your wise words and thoughts, and your, it may not be the most positive conversation in the whole world, but you always find a way to interject it with humor. And we are very grateful for that, because these are, you gotta hold on to the humor.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Do want to let folks know that next month, August 15th, we're doing our next podcast episode on understanding today's learners. We know that just released data, more students are online than in person. And shock of shocks, none of my higher ed folks are going to be surprised by this, college students don't look like 18 to 21 year olds anymore. And there was a wonderful piece put out this week, which really shows photographically who today's college students are. So we're going to have a fun conversation about really understanding who's coming to our college campuses this fall semester. So I hope folks will join us at that on August the 15th. And Melissa, I look forward always to learning from you. I got to start and end my week with you, and I don't think it gets any better than that. So thank you so much. Well, take care. And until next quarter.
Sounds great.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Friday 5 Live is brought to you by Innovative Educators. Innovative Educators offers 6 online services for your onboarding support and training needs. Visit us at innovativeeducators.org to see how we can support your student success initiatives.